Oliver Wickman, it's so great to have you with us, man. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've been busy. You have the collections box set out, right? That's been out for a couple of weeks, I want to say.
That's a pre-release out on April the 11th. It's Collaborations, the one with the guitarists that I've worked with. I've been quite lucky to work with some what prog rock legends, shall we say. And so, it was nice to collate the work that I did with them into a box.
What was and of course you have Dark Fables, which is one of your record that I think from last year as well. So you've been very, very, very busy. Talking about the box set, I mean, what was it like to put all that together and to obviously work with, all these incredible musicians? I mean, obviously Steve Howe, right? So many others.
It's a very there's a long convoluted story, and I'll try and give you the potted history version, which is that over the last few years, once we went into lockdown or just prior to lockdown, I was working on the Yes box set, which was From a Stage, which is the music I'd written with Yes that had never been released because when I left the band, they went off and did the record with Trevor Horn. And so the music that I'd written with the band and collaborated with the band on, it never got used. And I was going to put it on a solo record. But then when I heard that Chris had passed away, Chris Squire, the fantastic bass player, I sort of put a bit of effort into going through the old discs that they'd sent me and taking out all the parts and realizing that there was some amazing music and performances there. And I started to put it together. And so we ended up turning that into a box set, which was a live album and these songs, which had never been heard, which turned out to be sort of very, very popular. And the Yes fans really, really went for it. And then the management company said, "Oh, have you got anything else?" And that's when I ended up putting out the box set Tales by Gaslight, which was the work that I'd worked on with Clive Nolan, who is another keyboard player in the UK. And as part of that box set, we did an extra disc of unknown music, which was Dark Fables, that then got released separately. And then that led on again to the management company saying, "Well, that went rather well as well. Have you got anything else?" And it was like, "Well, yeah, I've got these records that I did with these guitarists, Steve Howe and Gordon Giltrap." Which gets us to the point of your original question of working with somebody like Steve, but it sort of makes sense to that. Because then what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump right back 20 years. Because long before I joined Yes, I knew Steve Howe from obviously with Yes when Dad was in Yes when I was a little kid. And then with that, when they put the ABWH band together, when Yes became Yes and another Yes in one of their many iterations. I went on tour with Yes just on a holiday. I was about 16, I think. My brother and I went on holiday. And I spent a lot of time hanging out with Steve and spent a lot of time talking to him. And we got quite friendly. And then many years later, I was hitchhiking across the UK. And a friend of mine said, "Oh, don't hitch that last bit. I've got a train ticket you can use." So I ended up at a train station and Steve was there, oddly enough, picking up his kids. And he gave me a lift and we sort of reconnected. And it was from that point that we started working on music together. And he said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm working on a record." And he said, "Oh, well, I'd like to play on that." And we ended up working on this record called The Three Ages of Magic, which is an instrumental record. Very, very, that was the best way of putting it. It was written in the wonderful way that musicians always hope they get to work, which is you write all the music, you don't worry about what a record company says. You get to choose the musicians you want to work with, and you get to record it where you want it to. So I sort of thought, "Great, I've got Steve. I found all these lovely local musicians that I knew from the southwest of England." And we recorded it in the middle of a barn, a tiny little studio in the middle of this huge barn in the middle of a farming complex. And it was just amazing. It was just the most amazing place to record it. And so that record then came out. And then over the time, as all these records do, they go out of print and then they disappear. And then when I left Yes, I ended up working with Gordon Giltrap, who is another fantastic guitarist. And so it seemed a perfect opportunity to pull all these two records together and people could hear work that I did pre-Yes and post-Yes. And it just seemed to fall naturally into place. So that's the sort of, I could have given you a much longer answer, but that covers most
No,
of what
I
I mean.
well, it's every bit of it's fascinating. I just wonder with so many different styles, it's got to be, is it a challenge to sort of play to, once Mr. Giltrap style versus Mr. Howe or something like that, or is it just comes naturally?
I th I think it comes naturally. I think you just find it all comes down to inspiration, essentially, as musicians. You end up working with somebody, and sometimes you can work with a musician that might be the most wonderful musician in the world, and nothing happens. And sometimes you work with musicians and you just go, oh, that's fantastic. That's great. I can hear something that I get. And you know, Gordon would send me, when I worked with Gordon on the record Ravens and Lullabies, he would send me little snippets of guitar stuff. I'd say, send me any ideas, you got any bits and pieces. And he'd send me like a little guitar riff across. And I'd end up the next day sending him back like a demo of a fully formed song. And he would say, how did you hear that? And it was like, it just came. You just needed the spark. And that spark was enough to get me on the journey to actually finish the song. And then with the stuff with Three Edges Magic, working with Steve, obviously it was a different approach with Steve because I was writing the music and he was executive producing and adding guitars on top. But as he was adding new instrumentation, I was finding myself taking things out that I would have wanted in there because actually there's so much he's bringing to this. I want to make that the focus now. And that's one of the things I've learned over years of working with musicians is I've always been very lucky in that I've always worked, even from when I was a kid, worked with people much older than me, which has always made me feel like the baby in the band. And so I've always had a lot to learn from these people, which is fantastic because, you know, my dad always says to me, music is the world's longest apprenticeship. You never finish. You're always learning. And so I've been 16, 17 and playing in blues bands with people that were 15 years older than me. You just had to learn really quickly. And I remember sitting with Steve and I'd say, oh, I'm going to do a solo here. I'm going to start off and do a solo right at the beginning. He said, no. I said, why not? He said, the music hasn't earned a solo by that point. I said, why not? He said, you can't. You build up, you earn, you get the listener engaged with the piece of music to the point that the listener is actually now committed to this piece of music. And then you can start taking it in and improvise. And he said these sort of things, which were really, really amazing things. And there are so many bits and pieces like that that I found from these different musicians that I learned. And that's always what I love doing, working with musicians that are willing to share and who are very, very giving musicians. And, the guys in Yes were always like that. They're always very generous musicians, I think.
Oliver, what was it like growing up with Rick Wakeman as your father, first off? I mean, it's a very obvious question, but I mean, it had to, he was obviously a huge influence on you and he taught you everything he knows.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to sound really odd, but yes, he was an influence on me. We've only ever done three shows together, I think, in the entire time I've been growing up. And we never actually sat at a piano together at the same time.
Wow.
Until 2005, I think it was. So I was about 33, 34, something like that. And we just didn't do it. We just talked about other things. And I remember once as a kid saying to him, oh, can you show me how to do that, Dad? And he said, learn it yourself. And I remember I said this to somebody once, oh, that's a bit harsh. And I thought, no, it's absolutely the right advice to give. You go and you learn stuff. So when I started the Yes tours, I did what any other musician doing that gig would do, which was I got all the CDs and I listened to them and I made notes and I stopped them and I started them and I rewound them and started and went for hours going, oh, what are they doing at that bit there? And slowly undid the jigsaw and managed to build all the keyboard parts. And this was 2008 when I joined Yes. So this was pre the days when you could go onto YouTube and somebody would have found all the separate tracks for you as well. So this was, you know, things that I would try to explain to my son and he just looks at me like I'm an idiot. He says, well, why didn't you just go onto YouTube and find it? It's like, yeah, because it didn't exist then, Arthur. It didn't work like that. But I always think that advice that Dad gave me back then was really useful because I do the same to my son now. I say, if you're just copying it from what somebody else has done on YouTube, you're not learning it. You're just doing a copy of what somebody else has done. Sometimes you can only understand it by actually feeling that you've put the work into break it down and understand what's going on. So from the musical point of view, he didn't teach me or play with me, and we didn't sit around the piano together as kids and do stuff. But his music was obviously a big influence to me because he left when I was five or six. And I didn't see him again for another 6 years, I think it was. But I found, my mum gave me some of his records when I got to, you know, my early teens. And I distinctly remember when Dad came back into the UK, his third wife, Nina, I said to her, I said, what's this journey to the center of the earth I keep hearing about? And then she just looked at, I remember this so clearly, she looked at Dad and just went, Rick? And he went, yeah. He said, how come your son here has never even listened to your journey to the center of the earth record? And he went, don't know. He said, well, don't you think it would be nice that you let him have a copy so he can listen to it? And then I sort of listened to that and all the Yes stuff, and I just got really into that sort of music. So he inspired me with the music, because before that, when I was a kid growing up, I had No Earthly Connection, which is still my favorite record that he did. But my inspiration when I was a teenager growing up was John Lord, oddly enough, from Deep Purple. Because I always thought what he did with an organ on, it's not, I always feel slightly bad with this, because I always tend to pick classic records that people go, well, that's the worst one they did. But for me, they're always the ones like, I always really like Tomato by Yes. And most classic Yes fans will go, oh, God. And then Deep Purple, Who Do We Think We Are, was always my favorite Deep Purple record. And I think that was, I know a lot of people said, oh, they hated each other at that point and were, you know, arguing. But there's some tracks on there like Rat Bat Blue and I think it's Place in Line. And there's some unbelievable organ work on those records that as a kid listening to it was like, how on earth are you doing that? And then when I went to watch John Lord in concert and watch him just kicking the proverbial out of these instruments, it was completely different to what Dad had done, because Dad was always very controlled and very flamboyant. John Lord had a sort of almost animalistic approach to kicking these instruments to make them go further than they were designed to do. So he was a huge influence as well. And then, you know, I also got influenced a lot by Dennis DeYoung from Styx. I was a big fan of Styx growing up from the songwriting point of view, the way that they managed to fuse really interesting prog and instrumentation stuff into very accessible music. I will get back to your original point. I do apologize. I do.
No, we love this. This is great. This is insightful. It's so insightful.
Then I end up in this weird journey, and then about an hour later, I go, "What did you ask me?" So those were the inspirations that got me into wanting to write and perform. But growing up with Dad in the early, very early days, as I say, up until about 5 or 6, he was around. He wasn't around a great deal because he was always away on tour, or he was always playing or in a studio, and I was with my mum a lot. But I do remember some very weird things when I was growing up, which is we had the pinball table room, which was a room in the middle of the house where he just had his collection of pinball tables. And I remember as a kid going in that room a lot. I remember saying to a friend of mine about it, and they said, you know, that's not normal, don't you? And I was like, isn't it? Doesn't everybody have a room like this? And they were like, no, they really don't. It's like, oh, okay. But you're a kid, you don't know any different. You just go, oh, okay. I thought that's everybody had one of these. And he had, and we had, what else do we have that I remember particularly? I remember laying on the sofa with him, and he had very, very long hair right down to his belt. And I was a four-year-old. I had very long hair down to my belt. There's a lovely photo of the two of us laying down with our hair over our back. I remember that sort of thing. And I remember that we had, I think it was the Tales from Topographic Ocean stage set in the garden for a while when they needed somewhere to dump it. So I remember looking out and seeing all these weird Roger Dean curve type things in the garden. And that all just sort of became sort of part of the norm, really. But people always sort of would say to me, God, that's a really amazing, unusual life growing up. But like I say, it was the only childhood I had. So I didn't really know any different to compare it to, if that makes sense. There sure. is a sort of distorted sense there.
Yeah.
But I was sort of aware of what Dad did, but not to the point that it was an amazing thing. Because as well, when I started growing up in my early teens, was the early 80s, I was sort of thinking, I was born 72. So about 84, I was hitting 12, 85, hitting about 13. So I was becoming a teenager and starting to go and buy records. And, you know, prog rock really wasn't in vogue back then. That was really a period of time where all the musicians, you know, the nostalgia kick really hadn't kicked in at that point. And they were all scrabbling around trying to, find work and do stuff. And Dad was doing a lot of records, many records per year, to try and sort of keep income coming in. And you know, I got almost bullied at school because of the, or teased, shall we say, rather than bullied, teased mercilessly about the fact that, you know, Dad was appearing on Good Morning Britain and Pebble Mill at One, which were British breakfast TV shows, talking about all these sort of obscure things. And all my friends were going, oh, it's not Duran Duran, is it? It's not Aha. And it was really difficult because, you know, it wasn't anything I could talk about. You almost had to sort of go, oh, just don't talk about it. And it was only when I got to be a teenager, sort of my late teens, like 16, 17, and one of the guys at school who had never really given me much time came over to me, and everybody was starting to discover music at that point. You know, when you get to 16, 17 and you start looking at records that you would never have, yeah, and you suddenly go, yeah, what's this?
It's amazing, and, yeah.
One guy came up to me and went, just heard Roundabout. I went, oh, yeah. He went, your dad saw that, didn't he? I went, yeah. He went, yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, you're all right. And walked off. And then suddenly it all changed because they became a lot more aware of that world. And so those are the things that I really remember from growing up with Dad. So it wasn't so much about what Dad did while I was there. It was more about how the world changed in that period of time, and how, as we grew up, the opinion of having a father that did this changed. I mean, I remember going to record shops with my friends, and they'd all pick up Duran Duran records, Aha, whatever was in the charts. And I'd be in the queue, and I used to do this, and pick up 2112 by Rush. And they were looking at it going, why are you buying a picture of a man with his bottom out on the front cover pointing? And it's like, well, because it looks really interesting. It looks like a great record. And it's like, you sure you don't want to pick up Aha? I was like, no, I'll pick this. And then I started to get to the point that I got a bit belligerent about it with them all. So we would go next time, and then I picked up a Deep Purple record. And they're like, why are you buying that? And then it got to the point, and I started, well, I'm going to push this even further. And I started buying things by Gong. So I was buying like the Flying Teapot, these obscure prog, avant-garde jazz type things. And I think they stopped asking me to go to town with them after that. But but so for me as a kid growing up, that was my journey into this sort of world of music. And I, you know, the bottom line is I just like the craziness of it. I like the fact that it doesn't conform to rules, or there are rules, but you learn the rules, then you break them. That's what I sort of always liked about it. Does that answer the question in some form?
Absolutely.
I like how you said, answer. Yeah. And I like how you say you learn the rules to break, and there's an art in that. And I wonder, like, because what you do is obviously considerably physical. Were there moments over the years where you had to physically train yourself to do, I mean, to get your hands to do, you know, some of these things? And how long would that take? I mean, is that part of the process?
Yeah, I mean, when you're touring, it's much easier because you're playing every night for 2 or 3 hours and your stamina does build up. And then, you know, I do sound checks every day. We're notoriously dreadful for doing sound checks. They would do a couple at the beginning of a tour and then it was like, oh, we're not going to do it. So I would go religiously every day and do a sound check and play and just warm my fingers up. So I always found that bit okay. And then when I've had periods of time where I haven't been out touring, particularly over the last few years, where there's been a lot of, like I said, box set work, where you're collating information, you're tidying up mixes, you're listening to music, so you're not playing as much. And when I suddenly realized, I thought, do you know what? I haven't sat and played the piano for ages. And I thought, I must sit down and play rather than just, you know, collate music. I must sit and play and create or just practice. And my hands felt so stiff, I suddenly found myself going, God, this is, how did I used to do this? This is really hard. And so I've actually now got myself back into the regime of actually practicing every day and just doing it to keep everything supple, because I'm, you know, I'm getting older now, as much as I don't like to admit it, but I've got to suddenly realize that I've got to look after these things. And it also gets phenomenally frustrating when you know you could do something and then suddenly you're unable to. And my son had to do his very first concert the other day at school. He had to do something where they had to play in front of some people in a bad situation. He said to me, he said, we had to play it 3 times in a row. He said, my hands ached. And I said, yeah, because you're only ever used to sitting there and playing it once, then going and doing something else. I said, you know, my first show with Yes was 3 hours or 3.5 hours, something ridiculous like
that. Wow.
I said, you, and that's 3 hours of not just your fingers moving quickly, but trying to remember all the weird time signatures and counting. And because, of course, once you're on stage, you can listen to a record and play along to a record and everything's lovely and clear. The minute you get on stage and everything's bouncing around the walls and the sound's jumping out and you can't hear what you thought you were supposed to be listening to, and you sort of get to a point and you go, okay, I know it's 17 beats from this point I start that. So you'll be going, da-da-da-da-da-da, 1, 2, 3. So you get to 17 and you start the next bit. And it's all that sort of stuff. It was a very, very mentally challenging gig with Yes, because you're having to remember so much and compensate for all the stuff that goes on around a live show. Again, I'd say to my son, don't just rehearse to the level that's required for the show or the performance. Rehearse above it, so when all the things that are unexpected kick in and they take your concentration away, you're still above the level that you need to do to perform a decent show. And I hope that started to sink in, because that is somebody taught me that years ago, and it was such an important lesson, because, you know, the amount of times you're playing and you need that extra headspace to go, oh, keyboard's on the wrong sound, but I still got to do this, and I've got to make sure, oh, pedal stopped working, that keyboard's turned off for some reason, what do I do? You need to have that ability to keep doing what's required and still deal with these other things as opposed to panicking. But yeah, it's all, yeah, fun days.
A life lesson that can work for anything too. I mean, that's actually quite brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll try and remember who it was that said it, but up until that point, I'll take credit.
Well, it has weight coming from you, considerable weight coming from you.
When you come up with a plan to make music, how do you go about the topics that you know, you've done Frankenstein, Hounds of the Baskerville, stuff like that? Where are you come up with the themes to even start making the music?
I generally just sit and write is where I generally start, and then some melodies come, ideas come, maybe some lyric ideas come, and then I write a piece, and then I suddenly almost write a story in my head of what I'm trying to do, and I try to write music that is maybe specific to a theme, but also has an emotional link to it as well. So you can take that piece of music out and it can mean something to somebody without specifically saying, and then Roger turned around and said this to Steve, and then blah, 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 blah. So you don't end up making something particularly specific, because the beauty of music is that people will often interpret things differently to how you've written it. I've been working on, in this box set, there's a new live album, and I've been putting together some video for you. I managed to find somebody that videoed one of the shows, and I'm putting some other bits and footage around it. And I played it to my wife earlier on and said, what do you think? Because in my head, the song was written about something happening in your life that was difficult. And the song's called Ravens Will Fly Away. And the ravens were all the sharp, hard things in your body, and you're trying to let them go, and you're trying to fly somewhere else. So the imagery in my head was desolation, ravens, all this sort of carrion type birds going on, and then an eagle or an owl or some sort of majestic bird flies away to lush Greenland, and you know, and that was the thing, darkness going into light, and all this. That was my imagery for it. Was as I wrote it, I remember feeling particularly bad, and it's like, no, I'm going to move myself away and get myself into a better space. And then she looked at it and she went, yeah, okay, I see what you've done there. I went, all right. She went, it doesn't mean that to me. I said, well, what does it mean to you? She said, I remember it thinking about when my dad died, how I had to let the pain go so that I could move on in my life. And I remember thinking, and that's always rung true with me, that it's about the emotion of a song that you're trying to get across. So what I do then, to answer your question, is I end up generally getting a few pieces that sort of group together, and then I sort of feel, okay, is there a direction that this piece of music is going in, or these collections of music that could become a themed album? So for Three Ages of Magic, for example, I was living in Devon at the time, and a lot of the music I was writing was about stories that I was reading about Devon folklore. And then people, I think I did an article in a newspaper, and somebody said, that's what I said I was doing. And suddenly people would, they knew where I lived, and they would post articles through my door. So I'd wake up one morning, go downstairs, and there'd be a ripped out page out of a newspaper about another little story that was only local folklore. And I would sit down and go, oh, that's interesting. And then I'd suddenly sit and write and think about what I'd read in that thing. And those pieces, so suddenly those songs became the Three Ages of Magic, which was about folklore and things. Whereas Howl of the Baskervilles and Jabberwocky, those two sort of rock operas I wrote with Clive Nolan, were because we knew we wanted to write something based on literature. And it was finding the right sort of story. And then something can happen that actually triggers where you go. I remember when we were writing this project, we didn't know what it was going to be called. And we were trying to decide what artwork we wanted for it. And I'm very good friends with the artist, Rodney Matthews, who's, you may know, is a very well-known artist, does an awful lot of classic rock record covers. And I phoned him up and I said, oh, we're thinking of doing this record about a literary piece of work. Have you got anything that we might be able to license off you? And then he said, oh, I've just finished painting the Jabberwocky. I'll send you a copy of the poster. And then the poster turned up and we looked at it and said, that's it. That's where the music has been heading towards. And the music that we'd written fitted perfectly with his imagery. And so we just carried it on. So there's always something that happens that make you go, this is the direction the music needs to go to. But for me, it's always about, I want to say it's always about the song, but because songs always imply that it's lyrics, it's always about the emotion that the piece of music or the song is trying to portray. Those are the bits that's important to me. And that's what generally gets me inspired about how to create either a standalone piece of music or a piece of music that's going to fit as part of an album. Does that make sense? I think so.
Yeah,
it did to absolutely. Me, sort of.
Well, I think that's why, you know, people say music is the universal language, and you know, you factor in lyrics with that too. But I think when you talk about instrumental and those, the musical, the emotional dynamics, it takes that point even higher. So no, I think that does really connect. I mean, it's really powerful. It's like, and it goes beyond language and everything, you know, you hear and you feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've listened to some music in, you know, in other languages, and I haven't got a clue what they're saying, because I'm a typical British person, which means I speak English pretty well, but I'm always rubbish at doing languages. And I'm particularly bad at languages because I'm...
Me too.
I don't have the brain that understands it. I have other people that I know that just are able to pick up languages without a problem, but I've always been really terrible. I've tried, but I'm terrible. But you can hear in the music, you can feel the emotion, you can hear in the way that the person is trying to deliver the lyric that you don't understand. You can hear whether they're happy, whether it's plaintive, you can get that. Yeah, it is, like you say, a universal language. It's just, it's an amazing thing. It's, if you tried to describe it to somebody that had never heard music, it wouldn't make any sense at all, but it is really an amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you finding the current situation that we're all in with the pandemic, you finding it a fruitful time for your artistic works, or you find it detrimental?
Yes and no. I think there's always the worry in the back of your head that, you know, it's affecting an awful lot of people. And as human beings, we all generally care about each other. And we know that some people find it harder than other people, you know, particularly when we were all in lockdown. You know, I was very grateful for the fact that I had a garden where I could go and take my daughter and my son out, and we could go and everywhere. And yet you're aware that a lot of people didn't have that luxury. And so you're sort of, you know, you are aware that this situation is hitting people harder in different levels. So there's always that sort of element that you're always aware that it's affecting people in a different way. So once you take, you know, once you appreciate that that is the way that the world is, and we just have to sort of find a way of getting through this situation. The other side of the coin, which is to do with the music and how I could best use this time that we had, was to try and go through music that I felt needed a chance to be heard that maybe I wouldn't have had the time to go and do. For me, I enjoyed that immensely, and it's given me a really good opportunity to go back through and find music. And like we were just talking about with songs, I found some pieces of music I'd never utilized, and it's like, actually, that's a really good idea. So I'm working on a new album from some of these ideas that I wrote years ago that had just been in a folder that I never would have considered. But I just suddenly went, actually, listening to these pieces of music now with the knowledge that I've gained since, I can actually rip those apart and actually make, because the theme and the melody and the emotion is really strong. Maybe I've learned more about instrumentation. So it was a great time to be able to spend time to actually delve into stuff. But I have found it particularly hard not playing live. Now, I don't play all the time, but I'd always sort of been quite proud of the fact that up until a year ago or 2 years ago, I'd played every single year shows of some description, whether it was a band, whether it was abroad, whether it was a solo piano show, duet, trio, with an orchestra, whatever it was. I'd always done something each year from the age of my first ever proper performance, which I think was probably 16 or 17. So I've done 30 odd years of playing every year and looking forward to things and thinking, right, I've got that coming, I've got that coming. And then to suddenly find that, A, there was nowhere to go and play. And even now we're starting to come out of it. Unless you're one of the very big, well-established bands with these audiences that have been sort of baked in around that artist, you know, some of us other artists who are a little reliant on real music lovers that go, actually, I want to go and watch that tonight. That it's still a rather uncertain time, because I'm sort of still thinking, well, I'd like to go and play. But obviously there's a lot of not just financial implication that comes of putting a show together, but it was also the time element of rehearsing for a great deal of time and other musicians' times. And obviously a lot of musicians will get together to rehearse and then they earn when they do the shows or the tour. And if you sort of then you think, I'm still not sure that the venues are right, you know, able to take the people on or make the money, it's still a period of time that's still a little uncertain. And but in there's a part of me inside that's just going, I just want to get out again. I want to put the piano in the back of the car, drive somewhere and play in front of people and tell silly stories, which is what I like doing. You know, that is, at the end of the day, the core of a musician is getting out and performing.
Yeah.